Few people are untouched by suicide. Most of us have either thought about doing it, attempted it, or have known someone else who has. The World Health Organization estimates that throughout the world, 1,000 people take their lives every day. In the United States, someone attempts suicide on an average of once a minute. And every day, 60 or 70 of those attempts succeed. There are more suicides in this country than murders or drowning. Only automobile accidents rank higher as a means of violent death. Even more startling is the opinion of experts that many suicides aren't reported as such, that some accidental deaths are actually cases of self-destruction. For example, many single-person automobile accidents are probably planned suicides. Victims of suicide range in age from 8 to 100, and perhaps even younger, as statistics are not gathered for children under 8. People of all ages and religions kill themselves, as do people in all economic situations. While most of the people who consider taking their own lives do so out of despair, some argue that suicide is a viable option to life, that philosophically rational people, under certain circumstances, should actually kill themselves. It is this philosophical question I would like for us to consider. I'd like to begin by giving the reasons for suicide. Throughout history, people have committed suicides for a variety of reasons, including duty, disgrace, imminent death, despair, and disease. We need to take a look at each of these. Duty is a common reason for suicide, and it was especially true in the ancient world. The mass suicide at Masada is an example. In 70 AD, the Roman general Titus stamped out the Jewish rebellion and destroyed Jerusalem. A number of zealots fled south to Masada, which was Herod the Great's old fortress. He built it in 37 through 31 BC on top of an isolated mountain of rock near the Dead Sea. After finishing off Jerusalem, the Romans marched to Masada and laid siege to it. For several years, there was a standoff. Meanwhile, Caesar's troops were constructing a ramp to the top. Finally, the leaders of the Jewish extremists realized that it was a matter of time before his people would be taken. He encouraged them to commit suicide, urging them that they should never be servants to Rome, or to any other than God himself. Out of a sense of duty, some 960 Jews killed themselves. Only 2 women and 5 children survived to tell the story. But this is not just an ancient phenomenon. Modern examples could be cited, such as kamikaze pilots of Japan, who flew planes into ships and died in a blaze of glory, or the Buddhist priests who set themselves on fire in Vietnam, even protesters who starved themselves to death, all motivated by a sense of duty. Another reason for suicide, perhaps more common in the ancient world than in the modern era, is disgrace. For some, humiliation and dishonor are so intolerable that death is the only alternative. Some college students today, fearing they have disgraced their family by not making a perfect grade point average, have taken their lives. A third reason for self-destruction is impending death. It sounds strange, doesn't it, that someone would kill himself so that he would not be killed by others, but that is exactly the idea. In some cases, it is not just death, but death by torture that is avoided. If someone else does it, they will torment the dying person first, or put him to death slowly and painfully. If the person kills himself, you will do it quickly. This was the case in Rome, where Caecina Pintus was condemned for being part of a conspiracy against Claudius in 42 AD. His wife encouraged him to commit suicide by first stabbing herself and then, as she lay dying, handing the dagger to him. The general in battle who sees that he is about to lose it often kills himself. Adolf Hitler was such a case. In fact, an American psychoanalyst commissioned by the United States government to produce a profile on Hitler predicted his suicide 2 years before he actually did it. The most common reason for suicide, especially in America today, is despair. This is the case that occupies most of the attention of psychologists and authors of magazine articles. Suicide occurs when one's outlook on life becomes one's despairing hopelessness. One author writing on the subject of suicide said that the one characteristic of every suicide was the loss of hope. To the potential suicide victim, life is a hopeless mess. In light of the fact that, among medical professionals, psychiatrists lead the list of suicide victims, that observation is most interesting. Disease is another cause of suicide. Physical deterioration or disease has become the new rationalization for suicide. In his book, Good Life, Good Death, Dr. Christian Barnard has said, quote, "If society insists that the doctor has no right to end the life of a dying patient, can it also insist that the patient has no right to end his own life? Should an individual, sane in mind, be condemned if, after careful assessment and the conclusion of the quality of his life has deteriorated to the point where it has become meaningless to be alive, he takes his life? I don't think so. I believe it is the fundamental right of any human who is capable of making a clear assessment of his situation to take his own life. It is a right because no one can stop him and no one can punish him for his action." End of quote. Dr. Barnard goes on to argue that suicide is a basic human right and should be the option always available to every individual. A Swedish public health physician wants to open a suicide clinic for more than 2,000 Swedes who killed themselves each year. He does not want to treat them, but to help them do it. Writing in the respected Swedish medical journal, he suggested that to help a suicide victim is related to the choice that women now have about abortion. Quote, "The right to die," end of quote, is the wave of the future. In fact, California, as do more than a dozen states, has a law allowing for a living will. Adopted in 1976, this law recognizes the right of any adult to sign a written directive instructing his or her physician to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining procedures in the event of a terminal condition. In August of 1980, a national organization called Hemlock was founded in Los Angeles to support active voluntary euthanasia. Years ago, British television viewers were allowed to watch a shocking scene. A police camera had been hidden in the bedroom of a nursing facility, and it recorded what was later aired. What the English watched in their homes and pubs was a 60-year-old woman urging her 87-year-old mother to end her life by suicide. "It's not cowardly, Mom," she said. "If you had a dog in this condition, you'd take him to the vet, wouldn't you?" The mother slumped in her chair, replied, but a dog doesn't have a soul. I am so afraid I'm being punished afterward." To this, the daughter replied, "Oh, Mom, you wouldn't be punished for this. Don't have any doubts. Don't bungle it, Mommy. Don't make a mess of it." The television audience watched as she pulled out 15 tablets of a drug to give her aging mother and urged her to take them with a strong drink of whiskey. It's always fatal, Mommy," she said. Then she left the room. Immediately, attendants rushed in and snatched the pill out of the hand of the woman, and her daughter was arrested as she left the nursing home. The videotape was introduced as evidence at the trial. She received a prison term for attempting to aid and abet a suicide. However, if the current trend continues, the scene will be commonplace and even legal in the future. What does the Bible say about this subject? Is it for or against suicide? From a biblical point of view, does a person have the right to take his or her life? There are cases of actual suicide recorded in the Bible. Having been captured and blinded by the Philistines, Samson was brought into the temple of Dagon to entertain them. He asked that a lad lead him to and let him lean against the support pillows. He then prayed for strength, saying, "Let me die with the Philistines." He pulled against the pillows, and the place came tumbling down, killing him and thousands of Philistines, according to Judges 16:30. King Saul is another example. He had been wounded in battle, and the enemy was about to capture him. He asked his armor-bearer to kill him instead. The armor-bearer refused. So Saul fell on his own sword, and when the armor-bearer saw it, he did the same. 1 Samuel 31, verses 4 through 6. There are other cases in the Old Testament. In 2 Samuel 17:23 and 1 Kings 16:18 through 19. But perhaps the most famous suicide in the Bible is Judas. After he betrayed Jesus and realized that Jesus would really be put to death, he tried to return the 30 pieces of silver. The chief priests and elders would not receive it. Consequently, Judas hanged himself. Matthew 27 verses 3 through 5. Of all the examples of the actual suicides in the Bible, all but Judas were in a battle situation with death or dishonor as their only other choice besides suicide. There is one case in the Bible of an attempted suicide. When Paul and Silas were in jail at Philippi, an earthquake freed them. Whereupon the jailer woke up, supposing prisoners had escaped. He drew his sword and was about to kill himself when Paul cried, "Do not yourself no harm. We are here." The jailer's life was spared, and he was saved not only physically but spiritually. Acts 16:27 through 28. The desire to die was expressed in two or three other incidences. Elijah was a bold and courageous prophet. He stood before the king and the nation and fearlessly proclaimed God's message. Then Jezebel the queen said, "I've had it with you. I'm going to get you." That caused the faithful and fearless prophet to flee and plea, "Lord, take away my life." 1 Kings 19:4. Reluctantly, Jonah prophesied to Nineveh. As a result, the whole city repented, and true to his word, God did not destroy them. Jonah became exceedingly angry because God was gracious and asked him to take his life, Jonah 4:1 through 3. It should be carefully noted that these two cases can be called death wishes at best. They were not even attempting suicide. They wanted death and expressed that desire to God. There's one other story that should possibly be listed. It's not an actual suicide, nor an attempted suicide. Technically, it's not even called a desire for death. But it is a questioning of life, and in the name of completeness, it should be listed. Job lost his property, children, and health. He then questioned why he was born in the first place. Job 3, verse 11. The Philippian jailer and Elijah were both facing the possibility of death when they contemplated dying. Jonah and Job did it out of despair. What are we to make of all this biblical data? Frankly, there are no direct statements concerning suicide in the Bible. As we have seen, they're only examples. So our conclusions about the biblical attitude toward suicide must be drawn primarily from these examples. Beyond that, there are perhaps some principles or implications which apply. From the examples, we can learn several things. For one thing, most who committed suicide or even thought about it faced death anyway. It is also obvious that a few did it, or at least thought about doing it, when faced despair. Job, Jonah, and Judas faced despair and contemplated the meaning of their lives and the possibility of death. It should also be pointed out that none of these men were models to be emulated at the time, and some not at any time. Samson and Saul were not exactly what they should have been, especially at the point of their death. Elijah and Jonah were out of it when they thought about suicide, and furthermore, when they asked God, God did not take their lives, but rather, in essence, talked them out of it. This is an important point in the biblical data. The men who did commit suicide didn't ask God about it first. The men who asked God about it first didn't commit suicide. The evidence from the examples, then, suggests that God is not in favor of suicide. Beyond the examples, there are two points that need to be pondered. One is a principle and the other is an implication. There is a principle in the Bible concerning the sacredness of life. Genesis 9, 5 through 7 teaches that human beings are made in the image of God. Life, according to the Bible, is a gift from God. If you destroy a gift, what does that say about your attitude toward the gift and the giver? There is also an implication that has a bearing on the subject of suicide. Exodus 20 says, Thou shalt not kill. That's the King James translation and the one that's most well known. The Hebrew word, however, is thou shalt not murder, which is the translation of the New King James and all modern translations. But notice there's no object. It does not say you shall not murder another. It just says you shall not murder. The implication is that that includes you as well as other people. My conclusion is that from a biblical point of view, an individual does not have the right to take his or her life. God gave people life, and only God has the right to take it or dictate when it should be taken by another, for example, capital punishment. For people to decide that they have the right to take their own life is to play God. James 4:12, in speaking about judging others, says that God is able to save and to destroy. Therefore, you should not judge. I wonder if the same logic could not apply here. God is the one who gives life and who destroys. Therefore, for us to do that is to take the place of God. For us as a society to conclude that an individual has the right to die will only promote suicide. Japan has a permissive attitude toward suicide and consequently has a higher suicide rate. At this point, I'd like to make some practical suggestions. The primary purpose of this discussion is to deal with the subject of suicide philosophically. That is, to answer the question, does an individual have the right to die? But frankly, most suicides we will personally encounter stem from despair, not terminal illness or approaching death. In psychiatric theories concerning suicide, guilt, inferiority, alienation, and anger are reoccurring themes. People commit suicide because of guilt, a feeling of having done something wrong, or inferiority, feeling that one has not reached his own standard, alienation, a lack of love. Loneliness and isolation makes life seem more horrible than death. Anger is often said to be involved. Suicidal people are self-centered and very angry with themselves and with others. But beyond all of these factors, one common denominator of all discussions on suicide is despairing hopelessness. With that clue, let me make some suggestions in dealing with someone contemplating suicide. The temptation is to brush it off by saying, "Oh, you can't or wouldn't do that," or to say something like, "You can't be serious." Granted, not everyone who threatens to commit suicide does it, or even attempts it. But on the other hand, almost all who do commit suicide talk about it first. So instead of brushing the threat aside, treat it seriously. Ask such questions as, "Do you have a plan?" That determines how serious the person is. Those who are not very serious don't have a plan, and those who are do have a plan. I've personally talked several people out of committing suicide at a point when they were about to do it. One of the things I did was assure them that I loved them. By listening and spending time with them, in one case many hours, I communicated my concern and love for them. But remember, the common thread in all theories of why people commit suicide is hopelessness. What we must do then is realistically show potential suicide victims that there is hope. That's what Paul did in Acts 16. When the Philippian jailer was about to commit suicide, Paul shouted, "Don't do that, we're all here." The Philippian jailer was going to kill himself because he knew that if the prisoners got away, the Roman government would kill him anyway. What Paul did was to show him there was hope. The prisoners had not escaped, and therefore there was hope that he would not die. Then Paul talked to him about the Lord. Paul took the first opportunity to preach the gospel, but it was not the first thing he did. Since the Bible is pro-life, we should do all we can to promote life, not terminate it. American society used to have at least a semblance of sane scriptural thinking on this subject, but it seems that recently it has gone crazy concerning the value of life. Some beginning to argue backwards from the Bible. They want to kill the death penalty so that criminals can live. They would also support abortion, active euthanasia, and suicide. That's backward. The Bible is pro-life. It teaches that we should kill killers, save babies, and promote life. Philosophically and practically, we must be against suicide. Regardless of what the critics say or how strongly a person is bent on committing suicide argues, we must, as believers in Jesus Christ, stand for life. If we do, they will thank us in the end. In 1972, I was conducting a citywide evangelistic crusade in one of the central cities of California. Several thousand people a night were attending the services. During the crusade, a young man decided to take his life. He had it all planned. He loaded the gun. Before he took the final and fatal step, he decided to say goodbye to a girl he knew in college. She wasn't his girlfriend, but she had befriended him, so he at least decided to say goodbye to her. When he arrived at her house, she said to him, "There's a crusade going on in town. Why don't you go with me?" They came. When I gave the invitation, the young man came forward and trusted Jesus Christ as his Savior. After the counselor led him to Christ, the new convert said, "Do you want the gun now?" The counselor had no idea what he was talking about and inquired, "What do you mean?" The young man pulled out a loaded revolver and handed it him, saying, "I don't need this now." The next day, the Crusade Committee sponsored a luncheon for a number of the service clubs in town. On each table was a potted plant as a centerpiece. At the end of the luncheon, the plants were sold for a nominal fee. Unknown to me, the young man who had trusted Christ the night before was there. He bought one of the plants, walked up to me, told me the story, and then said, "I would like to give you this plant. Last night, you gave me my life, and I would like to give you this life for the life you gave me." A life for a life. That's it. Instead of death for life, we ought to be giving life for life. And as we do, though they may not appreciate our attempts at the time, ultimately, they will thank us for it. To sum up this discussion concerning suicide, I would say, the Bible teaches that people are made in the image of God and therefore have value. Life is sacred. This Judeo-Christian concept of human beings and life has predominated the American culture throughout its history. From that view of human beings, several things logically follow. Since people are made in the image of God, everyone who premeditatively and deliberately destroys a human being deserves to be destroyed. Capital punishment at one and the same time demonstrates how valuable people are, how serious murder is, and that justice needs to be done. Since a fetus is a life, it reasonably follows that no one, not even the mother carrying the fetus, has the right to arbitrarily abort it and thus terminate its life. If horse owners practiced abortion as capriciously and widespread as women are currently doing in this country, there would be a national public outcry. Organizations would be formed to save and salvage the helpless horses. That should tell us something. A person doesn't have to have a Bible in his hand to know in his heart that the wholesale abortion of horses is not right. But horses are not created in the image of God. Are humans not more valuable than horses? A person ought to have a powerfully good reason before performing an abortion on a human being. Saving the life of the mother is a good reason. Since people are created by God in His image, only God has the right to say when that life should be taken. He has decreed that when one human murders another, it is proper and fitting for his life to be taken. He also permits individuals and nations to defend themselves, even to the point of the death of the attacker, if necessary. But beyond those exceptions, no one has the right to take a life, even his own life. Abortion, euthanasia, and suicide, whether legal or not, are being practiced in this country. The prognosis is that it will not be long before active euthanasia and suicide are as legal as abortion. That is already true in some countries of the world, and there are organizations in this country whose whole purpose is to get them legalized here. After that, infanticide is next. Once we accept abortion on demand, active euthanasia, and suicide as an individual right, and we make them legal, the next step will be to kill babies who are born deformed or deficient or just not wanted. Having abandoned the sanctity of life with abortion decisions, unless American society reverses itself, it will end up killing infants and the infirmed and the very young and the very old. The progression will be 1. The right to kill the unborn. That's abortion. 2. The right to die. That's suicide. 3. The right to kill. Mercy killings. That's euthanasia. 4. The right to kill the newborn. Infanticide. Then, 5. The right to kill unwanted, unneeded, at any age. That's murder. That's not as far-fetched as it may sound. It has happened before in history and could easily happen again. The abortion movement began in Germany about 1900. By 1911, it had the support of the intellectuals. After World War I, though it was still illegal, abortion became rampant. Then, the euthanasia movement against useless people was launched about 1920. Ultimately, Hitler came to power and exterminated 275,000 Germans, not Jews, Germans, because they were frail, infirmed, or retarded. Amputees from World War I were eliminated because they were of no service to the Third Reich. All of that happened in the land of Martin Luther. No less than Dr. C. Everett Koop, the Surgeon General of the United States, has said, quote, "The legalization of abortion on demand in the United States, if it is not reversed, will someday be looked upon by historians as the last turning point of the materialistic society and abandoning the advantages accruing in our society from a Judeo-Christian heritage in favor of a change in our culture where an unreal concern about overpopulation has replaced our traditional view of the sanctity of life. Regardless of one's spiritual understanding, his religion, or his faith, when he abandons the sanctity of human life in the unborn state, he seeks to live in harmony with a materialistic society that has permitted itself to be brainwashed to the point where words no longer have their original meaning. He has permitted expediency to replace natural law if he can tolerate the madness of abortion to avoid the inconvenience of pregnancy." End of quote. It should be obvious that as soon as one questions the value of human life, there really is nothing to prevent him from considering what human beings, under what circumstances, should rightly be exterminated. It takes almost nothing to move from abortion, which is the killing of an unborn baby in the uterus, to killing the retarded, the crippled, the sick, and the elderly. That is not an exaggeration. In 1973, a Nobel Prize winner had already suggested infanticide. Dr. James D. Watson, the man who discovered the double helix DNA in the genetic code, stated in a publication of the American Medical Association, quote, "If a child were not declared alive until 3 days after birth, then all parents would be allowed the choice only a few are given under the present system. The doctor could allow the child to die if the parents chose, and save a lot of misery and suffering. I believe this view is the only rational, compassionate attitude to have." End of quote. At first, infanticide will be practiced on the physically deformed and the mentally deficient, those with problems like spina bifida or Down syndrome. But if those considered unworthy of life because of physical or mental incapacities are to be eliminated, is it not rational, so to speak, to conclude that other undesirables should also be terminated? Will it not be concluded that some are unworthy because of their ethnic origin, economic potential, productivity, ability, and who knows what all else? Dr. Koop argues, quote, "Once any one category of human being is considered fair game in the arena of the right to life, where does it stop? If the mongoloid is chosen as the first category whose life is not worthy to be lived, what about the blind and the deaf? If the hopelessly crippled, confined to a wheelchair, and considered to be a burden on society is the first category to be chosen, what about the frail, the retarded, and the senile? It doesn't take much fanciful imagination to extend these categories to include certain categories of disease like cystic fibrosis, diabetes, and a variety of neurological disorders. The population-controlled people who are concerned about food supply have been very effective in influencing society's thinking on abortion. It seems very logical that eventually one of their targets could be the obese individual who not only has eaten too much already, but has to eat a lot to sustain his large body. It is very easy to slip into moral deception in a discussion of euthanasia. One starts from the point of view of abortion and says, I can see why you are against abortion, because after all, someone, preferably the law, must protect the fetus because the fetus is not in a position to protect itself. But when one is talking about euthanasia, if the person is willing to undergo a mercy killing, why should other people object? The answer is really the same as it is for abortion. Abortion on demand opens up abuses of which euthanasia is number one. Euthanasia opens up the opportunity at the early stage of the game for almost inconceivable fraud, deception, and deceit. Think of the burdensome elderly people, commercially burdensome, whose rapid demise could be looked upon as an economic blessing for the family. Think of the temptation to hasten a legacy. To sum up, since the Bible is pro-life, Christians should do all that they can to promote life and not terminate it. American society used to have at least a semblance of sane scriptural thinking on this subject, but it seems that recently it's gone completely crazy concerning the value of life. Some are beginning to argue backwards from the Bible. They want to kill the death penalty so that criminals can live. They want to support abortion, active euthanasia, and suicide. That's backwards. The Bible is pro-life. It teaches that we should kill killers, save babies, and promote life.